ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightline. News breakdown.
Well, one of Australia's longest-running defamation trials, with 40 witnesses providing often harrowing evidence about the behaviour of Australia's special forces, has been decided this afternoon. It was a huge story, a defamation case lodged by war veteran Ben Robert Smith against the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, The Canberra Times, and three journalists, has found that claims he committed four murders in Afghanistan were substantially true. The articles alleged he'd committed six unlawful killings, bullied a colleague, and committed domestic violence against a woman in Canberra. The domestic violence charge not sustained, although the others were, and in that instance, the judge dismissed Ben Robert Smith's cases. He found four of the six alleged murders were, in his view, proven true. He found the claim of domestic violence was not substantially true, but deemed that that could not further damage his reputation and therefore dismissed that case as well. Ben Roberts' lawyers will consider an appeal. This is Chris Masters and Nick McKenzie, two of the journalists who were involved in the story from the beginning after the verdict.
I don't want people to think of this as a bad day for Australian soldiers. I think of those soldiers that not only had physical courage, but also moral courage. Nick and I know them well. We've spent a lot of time with them. And, I'm proud that they're out there, that as journalists we can meet Australian people who are prepared to tell a difficult truth and stand up to it. It was 110 days of them being punished in the witness box, and they did so wonderfully well. I'm so grateful to all of them. Thank you.
I'd just like to say today is a day of justice. It's a day of justice for those brave men of the SAS who stood up and told the truth. Australia should be proud of those men in the SAS. They are the majority in the SAS, and they stood up for what was right, and they have been vindicated. We couldn't have done it without each other. We couldn't have done it without our brave colleagues in the newsrooms. We couldn't have done it without our editors. And we couldn't have done this without the best legal team in the country. So one word, justice.
Nick McKenzie there, one of the journalists involved, and before that, Chris Masters, the other key journalist involved in the story. Joining us tonight for our Nightlife News Breakdown is Karen Middleton. Karen's chief political correspondent for the Saturday paper and knows Australia's military involvement in Afghanistan well. Karen reported from Afghanistan between 2007 and 11 and wrote the book An Unwinnable War, which charted the motives, ambitions and negotiations that carried Australia into Afghanistan. Karen, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
G'day, Philip. Thanks.
Well, a big sigh of relief from the media outlets concerned. There was a lot at stake here, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was. I mean, public interest journalism was at stake. Defamation cases are notoriously difficult, and it's always difficult to stand up a story that has such implications, and this one was, you know, just about the biggest defamation case anybody can remember. So in that sense, it's a victory for journalism and it's a victory for truth. We know that Ben Robert Smith's lawyers have indicated he'll think about whether he's going to appeal, so that is yet to run its course. But from a journalistic point of view, and as someone who knows one or two Special Forces soldiers who've long said that this was their view about what happened, I'm pleased at that decision.
Yes, there may well be an appeal, although you shouldn't assume that necessarily will result in anything of a different verdict either.
No, that's right.
Particularly on these findings of fact, which Judge Anthony Bosanco found, that four of the six alleged murders, he said, were proven true. This is Nick McKenzie again this evening on What Where To Next.
What's happened today? A civil court, to the balance of probabilities, it's a lesser standard than a criminal court, has found the allegations of war crimes to be true. We know that the Office of Special Investigations, we know the Federal Police are investigating Ben Robert Smith. That came out in court. It's a fact. It's now for the Commonwealth authorities to keep gathering the evidence. I'm sure they're looking very closely at our case. But, of course, they do have that different standard of proof. If the Director of Public Prosecutions believes there's enough evidence at the end of the day to prosecute, that's a decision down the track, then that is what will occur. But that's a long way to get to. I think what this case, though, does tell the nation is there needs to be more accountability. Yes, journalism has been vindicated, but there's not real justice for the victims in Afghanistan. There is not real justice for the SAS whistleblowers unless the criminal justice system, the ultimate system of accountability, kicks in. And I think that's the next place where this scandal will go.
And that's a big question, isn't it, Karen?
Yes, it is. And Nick's right there. You know, the burden of proof is much greater in a criminal trial than it is in a civil trial, in a defamation case. So the bar is much higher to clear, and that's why these things are going to take a very long time to even get near a courtroom. But, you know, I can understand Nick's sentiment on behalf of those families in Afghanistan that feel that they haven't yet quite had justice, that they'll feel vindicated to a point about today's decision. But what they really want is to see people who perpetrated offences in Afghanistan brought to account.
There's a huge amount of money involved here too. I mean, the case involved silks, you know, all right, left and centre. Went from
tens of millions of dollars, yeah.
Maybe up to $40 million if you look at the whole case, maybe at least $25 to $30 million. I mean, it's an astonishing sum of money. Okay, the media companies might have some money. Ben Robert Smith doesn't have that kind of money. He was staked by Kerry Stokes, the owner of Channel 7, with whom, of course, he's still employed. He's still employed by Channel 7.
And that was another layer of this, of course, because the journalists that they sued were from Nine. So, of course, the traditional rivals of Seven and Nine were literally on opposite sides of a courtroom battling it out, and the Nine journalists have come out triumphant. And as you say, it's Seven West Media that are on the other side of it. And we don't know yet exactly what costs may be awarded, what Nine will seek in terms of costs, but you know, up to, as you said, $25 to $40 million are on the table here in terms of what it's cost. 100 days of hearings, never mind all the preparatory time that went in ahead of that. So, yeah, it's a lot.
Federal government's not saying anything at the moment. A spokesperson for the Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister, Richard Marles, said it's not appropriate to comment. But there are international complications, apparently. It's big news around the world. And reported by the Washington Post, Al Jazeera, The Guardian, South China Morning Post, just to name a few. But the US has apparently got issues about their military working with forces who've committed war crimes. And the independent Senator Jackie Lambie said today the Chief of Defence, General Angus Campbell, should be sacked for not telling the current Minister, Richard Marles, about the warning issued by the US Embassy over cooperation with Australia following the Afghanistan war crimes allegation. Senator Lambie says it's beyond belief that the current government wasn't told.
This is a big thing that should have been alerted to the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, and he should have known about this. And if he hasn't been told, quite frankly, that should be a sackable offence and CDF should be gone. As a matter of fact, he should never have given him a two-year extension.
What's going on here, Karen?
Well, yeah, good question. This is about a US law, a provision in US law that says that US special forces can't work with other countries' special forces where human rights abuses have been found to have occurred. So that's the issue here. The letter was said to have been written, I think, in 2021. My understanding from the evidence of the Chief of the Defence Force to the Senate Estimates hearings this week is that the issue was resolved. So without knowing exactly what happened in terms of whether the current minister, who wasn't the minister at the time of the letter, has been told or not, it may be that the Defence Force believes that the issue is no longer an issue and doesn't need to be reported up. I don't know, but I certainly know Senator Lambie's got it in for some of the defence chiefs, and particularly the CDF, Angus Campbell. She's very angry at Angus Campbell on a number of fronts, but and not least, well, this issue that she's raised, but also the issue of war crimes and the fact that he has written to a number of soldiers asking for them to hand back their medals earned in Afghanistan in relation to allegations that have come out through the Brereton inquiry into war crimes. And Jackie Lambie and some of those soldiers believe that because Angus Campbell was in fact the Middle East commander at the time that some of these alleged offences occurred around 2011, that he was in the chain of command and responsible and hasn't taken accountability, hasn't been held accountable himself and should hand back his distinguished service medals, which he has not yet volunteered to do. So she's particularly angry at him about that, has been on about that this week and is threatening to hold things up in the Senate until something is done about that. and now she's raising this other issue. So there are a range of things Jackie's upset about.
If Ben Robert Smith was the subject of criminal proceedings, where would they come from? The federal police?
Well, yes. So it's interesting. The legal process is quite interesting here. The Office of the Special Prosecutor was set up in the wake of the findings of the Brereton Inquiry. And there's a sort of an international element to this as well, because if under international law, if our country is not seen to be dealing with properly with allegations like this that are in the international domain in some respects about war crimes, we can be subject to the International Criminal Court, which could mean that our soldiers could be prosecuted at the International Criminal Court. Now, Australia is a party to the court. Other countries, some other countries don't recognise the court's jurisdiction. We do, but that means we need to make sure that we can prove we have adequate legal, investigative and judicial processes in this country to deal with these allegations. And if we don't have those, that's when we could be vulnerable to being having our soldiers taken to the criminal court. So, you know, there's a lot of legal layers to this, but it would be a standard criminal process once the special prosecutor has dealt with the issue and finds a case to answer. It would then go, as I understand it, through the regular criminal processes to the police and DPP.
But one thing's for sure, it won't be left where it is, will it? It can't be.
Well, in the case of Ben Robert Smith, I don't know. I'm not sure what the process is. I don't know what the interaction will be between the Office of Special Prosecutor and the findings of this civil case. You'd have to assume, as a lay person and a non-lawyer, you'd have to assume that the Office of the Special Prosecutor would have been watching this case very closely because it has become this strange de facto war crimes trial. That's why it's so bizarre and unusual. You've got people with protected identities in the special forces. You've got allegations of crimes being committed by a highly decorated soldier in another country. And as you've said, all these high-profile media figures and large sums of money. So it's a mind-boggling case all around, but you've got to assume the special prosecutor has been watching and gathering evidence along the way.
Karen Middleton's with us, Chief Political Correspondent for the Saturday Paper. Oh, look, on to another one, PwC. We've been talking about this a lot this week, a big scandal.
Just another little straightforward issue. Nothing much to see there.
Some people mightn't welcome this, but it was kind of predictable that former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull inserted himself into the whole debate.
One is a breach of confidential information, which I say is mind-boggling and I think could have absolutely existential consequences for PwC. And it's a problem in professional services firms because you can get one or two partners who do the wrong thing and then that impacts on the reputation of the whole business.
Yeah. Karen, do you think it's likely that the National Anti-Corruption Commission might look at this when it comes into existence on the 1st of next month?
Well, I'm feeling sorry for the commissioners already because there seems to be a list of things being delivered to their door before they even exist. Look, you know, you have to assume it's possible, although I'm not sure how that works with a referral also having gone to the Australian Federal Police, because normally it might work the other way around, that an anti-corruption commission would examine something and if they felt there was potentially a case to answer in a criminal sense, then it would go to law enforcement. So if it's gone straight to law enforcement, I don't know whether that means that a corruption commission can't examine it. I'm not sure about that yet. But certainly there's a way to run yet in this whole issue. We've had 2 weeks' worth of Senate estimates hearings unravelling all of it. We've heard department and agency after department and agency explaining how many contracts they have with PwC worth how many tens and hundreds of millions of dollars, how they've all gone back to the company now and sought assurances about confidentiality, how so many agencies have PwC as their internal auditors, including the Treasury and the Federal Police, and there's a huge question about conflict of interest and the line, the separation between someone who's working as a public servant in the public interest and someone who's working as a private sector employee in a corporate interest.
Exactly. I mean, I see the Health Department in Senate estimates says, well, it's not going to engage PwC in any new contracts, but the work goes on for the 12 contracts that it's got with a firm totaling $25 million. I mean, the truth is if they want to unravel PwC, they're going to unravel half the business of Canberra, aren't they?
Well, that's right. The Reserve Bank governor was in. He was being asked about a problem they've had that's been revealed about underpaying Reserve Bank staff. He said, oh, we've had to hire some contractors to help us with our governance arrangements. And I think it was Greens Senator Nick McKim said, well, who have you hired? And he said, oh, PwC. So, you know.
Someone said they've got 400 staff down there, PwC in Canberra.
Well, would yes, that be right? I think it's been, it's a big office, but I think it's been said that some of these allegations did not, weren't focused on the Canberra office so much as offices further afield. But certainly it's not great for the company. And now they've been told by the Tax Practitioners Board, which is the government board that oversees the behaviour of tax agents, and that's the board that has deregistered one of the PwC partners, Peter John Collins, and rebuked the company generally over the release of this confidential information and the breach of a confidentiality agreement. The Tax Practitioners Board is looking very closely at all this and has now demanded that PwC release the names of those involved. And that's what they've avoided doing studiously for weeks and weeks, and they've now agreed that they will do that. So, you know, it's not over yet for the company. And, you know, what Malcolm Turnbull says is potentially right. It has huge implications for the company going forward, I would have thought.
You would have thought that it's over for them. They'll have to reconstitute. They'll do an Arthur Anderson, won't they?
I would hate to, I don't know. I'd hate to predict, but you'd have to think they'd be sitting around in around boardrooms at the moment trying to work out the public relations strategy, because it hasn't been terrific to this point.
Exactly not. Now, meanwhile, just and finally, the Prime Minister, who is a relentless traveller, I note just by way of side observation. He's off again, though. He's meeting with regional neighbours, Singapore and Vietnam, which of course is increasingly important for us. You heard the briefing this morning. What's he aiming to do?
He's off to the Shangri-La dialogue, which is one of these security dialogues that are held in various places around the world. I went to one on the Northern Hemisphere late last year called the Halifax International Security Forum, and this one's the Shangri-La dialogue, which is the sort of Asia Indo-Pacific version. And he'll be giving a speech there tomorrow, off the back of our defence strategic review, the Australian defence strategic review that was released recently, but talking about regional security generally. And I think he's going to try and frame that in the context of, this is not just about a fight between the United States or tensions between the United States and China. It's about the future of all relationships across the region and all countries around the region's ability to have to be autonomous, to determine their own future, to have sovereignty, to not have other countries impinging on their territory, to be able to trade freely. And he's talking about sort of trying to put guardrails around the big powers' relationships so that, you know, everyone has a place in the region and big powers don't take over. So it's interesting form of diplomacy, both advocating on behalf of where Australia is going in a defence sense, but also trying to put that in a wider regional context. And, of course, Singapore is important to Australia for a number of reasons, but it's where we get almost all of our fuel from these days. And part of this issue about strategic autonomy and our defence strategic review is that Indian Ocean passage northwest of Australia up into regions like Singapore and you know, making sure that is secure for our trade routes. So there's a lot at stake, and he'll be having some conversations up there about that. But unfortunately, the old Singaporean Prime Minister, Lee Hsien Loong, has gone down with COVID. So the bilateral plans with him are off, and I think the Deputy Prime Minister, Lawrence Wong, who's being touted as the successor when the incumbent decides to step down, he's going to be in charge. So there'll be conversations there, and then Prime Minister Albanese is off to Vietnam, which, as you say, is an increasingly important regional partner, increasingly important economically. It's positioned in North Asia, not too far from China. It has its own concerns about China.
They don't like the Chinese, let's face it.
That's right.
Well, put it this way, they've got history, haven't they?
Yeah, and so I think Australia, and this is not just the new government, well, it's a year old now, but successive Australian governments have tried to get closer to Vietnam over recent years. It's been enlisted in terms of keeping that big power stability, keeping the United States engaged in the region. It's part of APEC. So Mr. Albanese sees this as important. He wants to broaden and deepen the relationship in a trade and investment sense, but also in a strategic sense. So we'll see what he comes up with.
Indeed. Karen, always great to talk. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.